At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hurl. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analysts and stock markets commentator Paul Scott. So big welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everyone. Sorry we were 2 minutes late. It was my problem faffing around with microphones and speakers and things. But we got there.
Well, it's been a really, really busy week, both with sort of corporate news, but also M&A. And let's kick off in the latter camp straight away. We had a agreed cash bid by Swedish engineer ABB for engineering company Rotor this week at 506p, a 72% premium. So well done, any shareholders who have had a gangbuster time this week. What's your thoughts on whether this deal's going through? They did three previous offers, apparently, but what's your quick take on it?
Like you say, really generous premium. I mean, I think I've got to recalibrate how I value shares, because I looked at Rotork and just thought, oh, well, it's fully priced on a PE of 17 or 18 times. Looks about right. Then bang, someone comes in and offers 73% more for it. So it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it is difficult to predict these things, because often an acquirer, as you know better than I do, Paul, they see something in the business that they can do synergies with, that they can, you know, bolt on products and people. There's often angles on it that are nothing to do with valuation, really, isn't it? Just yet another example of British listed companies being pounced on and bought out by acquirers. So I think it's an agreed bid, this one, isn't it? I can't get the details up on my screen, but
yeah, it's an agreed all cash bid. I mean, it's sort of like 19 and a half times EBITDA and nearly 27 times PE for this year. Trailing. So it's a real top price. And really what it is Rotork is a trophy asset. There aren't many like this in the world, and it specializes in sort of like, say, these actuators that allow fluid, gas, and powders to be transferred through pipes, sometimes very big pipes, and they've got a big exposure to oil and gas. And I've fallen into the same trap as you, as much as anything. I've always looked at this and thought it was a high quality company, but the valuation has never been particularly cheap. And even when it has got cheap, it's still been on very high teens PE ratios. And I've always thought, okay, well, you know, am I going to play top dollar? But clearly, because it's a trophy asset, when it goes, it goes, and ABB wants it. It's flush with cash, because I think ABB have recently sold their robotics business to SoftBank, and therefore are double downing into automation. And they've got about a $20 billion war chest, of which this is only about five. So expect more to come. I mean, if you look at sort of like the UK, we've always been very good at sort of like, you know, engineering. We've had Spectris go, Oxford, you know, Instruments, is likely to be on the hit list as well. There's plenty of others which are just world-class engineer. I mean, you know, Goodwin would be always in the crosshairs, but it's family controlled. So, you know, I think this is a done deal. I can't see.
It looks that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does, yeah. And I don't think there's any competition issues either.
No, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? Because people obviously have the emotive and the maybe politically upset about British industry all being bought out and whatever. But I think the other thing to remember is that, and I share that concern, really, it would be nice to have, you know, these companies remain independent. But actually, we have seen historically throughout my lifetime, often when foreign buyers come in, they actually invest better and run companies better. You know, so it's not necessary. Does it ultimately matter who owns the company if they're going to go do a good stewardship job? I think certainly German and Japanese owners of businesses have taken a much more long-term and more willing to modernize and invest. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
No, I think with ABB, they're paying top dollar because they're going to invest in it, aren't they? I mean,
are they Swedish? Am I imagining that?
They are. They're Swedish. Yeah, they're they're global but Swedish. They as I say, they're big into sort of automation, and were into robotics, which they've now sold apparently. But
okay.
So expected. Yeah. Okay, let's move to another one. Another thing, many investors have done well out of this. Gooch & House Co. It basically got an offer of £12.30 from private equity house Arlington Capital. Seems to be an agreed deal, albeit there's still irrevocables are only about 0.5%. But I think everybody's done pretty well. How do you see this one?
Yeah, well, again, we thought we looked at this one. It was a 41% premium, which is reasonable, isn't it? I don't like the opportunistic bids, but if they cough up 40% plus bid premium, and it's normally around 30 something, isn't it, for bid premiums? And the shares have been doing quite well prior to that. I mean, we looked at it in June and we said, look, it's on a 25 times forward PE, similar sort of thing to what we were just saying on Road Talk. We thought Gooch & House Co is a nice business, but you know, price looked fully up with events, and bang, a bidder comes in, pays 40% more. So I think it's a fair deal. And looking at the chart you've got up there, you know, you're getting that. It doesn't look opportunistic. It looks a fair deal. It's recommended. So I would imagine this probably goes through as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any competition issues. It's about 13.5 times forward EBITDA. And given that it's a photonics business that's got quite a lot of exposure to aerospace and defence, then it's in a hot air and you can see why they're going to buy it. The share price is only is trading at £12.18. And given the bids at £12.30, that says to me there is a chance that actually somebody comes off the top and it would be a trade. I think this is a very fair price for a private equity deal. It's not a fair price for somebody like ABB coming out the woodwork, particularly if you're American, because I think they've got, as I say, I think they bought a photonics business not long ago in America. I got this one wrong again. I mean, a lot of people have highlighted it to me and I've had a really good look at it and I never got my head around the 30% gross margins. And I was a bit sort of short-sighted, you know, one of those. How much competitive advantage has it got over sort of cheaper rivals out in Asia? And I missed it. And I mean, basically, it's USP clearly, and its competitive moat is that it puts these into, you know, Western businesses that are not going to go to China or go to any other country whereby, you know, you've got potential sort of like security issues, and then it gets a nice bid. So hats off to everybody who's done well. I mean, you look at the share price, it was only about 12 months ago, it was April 2025, it was trading at below £3.30. So
We were positive on this one. Looking through my notes of the last 18 months, we were positive on it three times in the spring of 2025, when it was about between £5 and £6 a share. But then it warned on profits in October, which knocked them back. And we've only been amber on it since. I mean, it doesn't stand out to me as an exceptional company. Although, as I say, the H1 results were not bad in June. So it's a bit of a recovery turnaround thing. Odyssean are in this one. They've had a whole series of wins, haven't they, where they've correctly predicted turnarounds and bids. So hats off to them.
Yeah, no, it's been good. That's Stuart Whittleston, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move to another one. Let's go to System One, which is a specialist advertising business that helps corporates improve the efficiency of their advertising campaigns. In fact, we'll actually test it before you actually spend the money. So it's very much in sort of like in a hot space. It went through a real tough period about a year ago, first half, had a better second half. Anyway, as we've talked about before, the Brave Bison brothers, Ollie and Theo Green, who had 28% of this business, has decided to go to shareholders and put a cash and stock offer, which the board of S1 have rejected categorically this morning.
Yes.
How do you see this one panning out?
I think it's interesting company. I've been quite keen on System One for a long time, but it's so erratic, its performance. This is the trouble. And I can remember listening to it because I was in Victoria in Gozo. I always remember where I was when I listened to podcasts. It's weird. And basically the market just absolutely fell out of their the bottom fell out of their market last summer. September. Here we are, profit warning last year. Management were incredibly negative. Then you had the bizarre thing where the founder and 20-something percent shareholder jumped ship and sold his shares to Brave Bison, which is utterly bizarre. We've discussed that before, so I won't labour that point. And now, completely unsurprisingly, Brave Bison has bid for the whole thing. We thought that was going to happen. It was obvious, isn't it? And you would have thought they would have got the deal agreed, but System One have categorically, unequivocally, unanimously rejected it multiple times, haven't they? I haven't seen the webinar yet. Apparently, a presentation Brave Bison have put on their website yesterday as to the rationale for their bid. So I must have a look at that. So maybe people can have a look at that. I think if I was a System One holder, which I used to be, I'm not anymore because I got fed up with it being so erratic and lumpy. I think I'd much rather hold Brave Bison shares. So I think it's not just about price. I think this is actually about you're taking a tiny, extremely erratic company and you're rolling it into getting shares in a much, much better buy and build group. So I think there's a lot to be said for this deal. I hope it does go ahead. But, you know, System One management are doing their job, aren't they? They're trying to extract the best price.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the actual numbers now, because it's a stock and cash deal, I think there's only about, if I remember rightly, 68p cash, and the rest is in 2.75 Brave Bison shares. When you run the numbers, and I did this morning, it comes down to a blended price of £3.08. The shares are currently trading at over £3.30. So clearly the market is saying we're going to get a better deal. And because the Brave Bison made that announcement going straight to their shareholders, then it looks as though forcing both boards together to have an agreed deal. Now, given that there's already a premium in there of roughly around 10%, I think that share price, to me, the people in the know are saying Brave Bison are going to put a bit of about, I would say, 370 or above to get this one over the line, because you know that's quite unusual. And then you think about, okay, well, where do Theo and, because you and I have spoken to Theo, okay, this is total and Ollie, and it comes to total conjecture, okay, but their strategy could be twofold here, okay. If they can get the deal, that's great, and it's going to be earnings accreting at the price. But if they can basically trigger somebody else to come in over the top at a top bid, they can act as the kingmaker, because they can block it or accept it. And they may do, if somebody comes in with a £4 all cash, given that they bought their 28% stake, I think it was in the about 240 or something like that.
Was it? I can't remember.
Yeah. I think Ollie and I think it was on their blended. I think they're on their average. I think Ollie and Theo would say, okay, right, I'll give you, I'll sell you my 28%. A bit like, remember Science Group? They did the same. When you get a trade buyer coming in over the top. So I think Ollie and Theo can win two ways here. Somebody else a trade buyer comes in with £4 of cash, for instance, right? Happy days, I'm taking that on it. Or alternatively, I think they've thought about the synergies between this group, and they've gone to shareholders, and they knew before they went to shareholders it was going to be more than what they offered originally, just to force them together. So they were going to, I think they're going to win at less than £4 anyway. So if I was a Brave Bison shareholder, I would say, well, you can win both ways here.
Yeah, and you're right. There's a whole range of possible ways of dealing with it, isn't there? One is just to sit on their hands and say, well, no, we're not going to improve our offer. We're going to just sit here and be a bloody nuisance. And we've actually got the founder of your company is now working for us. Do you know what I mean? They could make it very difficult for System One, couldn't they? So, but look, everybody's just trying to squeeze the best price out of it, aren't they? I just, for me, as a small holder in Brave Bison, I don't want to see them overpay or over-dilute for this. But we'll see. It'd be an interesting one to watch, I'd say.
Yeah, I don't think there's any chance of them diluting on it, to be perfectly honest. I think they're too astute. Okay, let's move to another one. Let's go to Ramsden's, the pawnbroker, or effectively shops. They do jewellery sales, secondhand and watches and stuff like that. Plus, they've got a cash business. They've had an ongoing sort of like takeover deal from First Cash, which owns H&T. In the UK. Well, anyway, they agreed a deal about, I don't know, a month ago or 2 months ago at £6 a share. And because effectively their institutional owners have said, that's just not high enough. I'm sorry. You know, I want a similar EBITDA multiple as that you paid for H&T. They've come back with a better bid at £6.75. How do you see it? Really good for shareholders anyway.
Oh, fantastic outcome for shareholders. And it does raise the question, you know, how do we treat takeover bids? Because in the past, I think a lot of people have thought, well, I have as well myself, well, deal risk, you know, quite a lot of them fall through. But at the moment, we're kind of seeing the opposite now, aren't we? We're seeing quite a lot of these things do go through, and as in this one, actually get improved. Well, I can't forget which one it was, but we had another one the other day that was improved as well. So, and like you say, you could have another party coming in over the top. So you just have to assess each one on its merits, don't you? But yeah, very, very well done to shareholders. It did also put out a positive upgrade on trading, Ramsden's did. I think the midpoint of the new profit range was raised 6%. So that justifies about half of the increase in price, because it's about a 12% or so increase in price. So yeah, but lovely outcome, isn't it? Yeah, I'd be very happy if I was a Ramsden shareholder.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they've just got a fair price for a good business, and I think everybody now, the key institutions, I think, was Downing, was Judith McKenzie, and she wrote a letter. I saw, you know, basically a column in the Times talking about she was voting against it at £6.
Oh, I didn't see that. That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, one of your subscribers mentioned it actually, and then now she's given the letter of intent, you know, letter of acceptance, basically. Not irrevocable, but a letter of acceptance, essentially. Yeah. Comfort letter, I think they call it, don't they?
Yeah. Well done, Judith. Yeah.
I know, yeah.
Nice bit of negotiation there. Impressive.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, well, we've got a couple of people asking about our conversation with Vin Murrier, the queen of advanced ADVT. We've got WMIN 13. Anyways, what was your take from our conversation? Basically, advanced ADVT are a software buy and build company. Vin Murrier has had a fantastic track record of buy and build software over the over the decades, and the company has basically got about 50 million or so of turnover from software business. It's got about 100 million of cash, and it's got I think it's about a 10% stake in M&C Saatchi, which is worth about 20 million quid. Its market cap is about 210. What was your take from our conversation?
Oh, it was brilliant. I mean, she's just fantastic, so knowledgeable and experienced. And it was a masterclass, really, wasn't it, for us in tech software sector, M&A. And she was a bit miffed with us about, I mean, I can't remember us saying this, but apparently I think it was more you than me, actually.
It was me. It was definitely me.
You'd made rather flippant comments about how, she doesn't put prices up or something. Whereas she wanted to talk us through, when we do M&A, it's a much, much bigger process. And she just talked us through the step-by-step approach whereby, you know, they analyze all the ins and outs of the business. And it's a much more detailed process than we'd perhaps realize. But just fantastic. And she gave some really good examples of, you know, previous deals where they'd, you know, found that the software basically had much more pricing power than the incumbent management had realized and all this sort of thing. There was nothing new in the call that she hasn't said publicly, really, in RNSs. She's happy to hand the cash back if they can't get the right deal. And the reason for that was she said, I know I can raise money fresh once I've got a deal that I can take to investors. So that, I think, is very confident. You know, she's not sitting on the cash as a comfort blanket. I think the shares are really good, ADVT. I should disclose as well, I've picked up a few for my friend's ISA that I manage, Lynn's ISA, because you've got about half the market cap in net cash, as you correctly say. You've got this really good track record of buying the existing, you know, disciplined acquisitions where they only buy things that they can turn around and really transform quite quickly. And you normally with these sort of superstar management, you're asked to pay a big premium, aren't you? Here, there's no Vin Murrier premium at all. If anything, the shares are discounted below fundamental value. So I think it's a really good stock to just buy and tuck away and see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you run the actual the numbers and you deduct the sort of the cash, and then you also deduct the 20 million or almost 20 million of the shares in M&C Sarts, you get you get the software business for about 1.7 times sales. Now, that is really cheap for,
and it's very high margin as well, isn't it? The software,
yeah. Well, that's right. And also you get Vin Murria, who's basically improving those. And certainly what she said to me, which I didn't appreciate, because there's been a lot of criticism in terms of that, those businesses that are just growing in the low single digits, organic growth. But she's putting a lot of it, or the company is, the board, putting a lot of investment into R&D, particularly building out AI agents to help their customers, that they're going to accelerate that organic growth. Probably, who knows, but probably into the high single digits. None of that is currently in the forecast. Now, if that happens, then you will get definitely a re-rating. It's probably three times sales would not be, you know, sort of insurmountable. And also, which, you know, what I love, I mean, this is obviously my meat and drink, isn't it? You know, in technology in software and stuff. But certainly which was opened my eyes was, you know, she was very positive on their focus of UK public sector, because I've always steered well clear of it because, you know, the budgeting of the public, of the government, has always been very tight. But she says, look, you can make some good money on it, particularly if you get the right products. And the other thing which I did take away from, I mean, let's be clear about it, you know, she's slightly older than us two, but probably has got the energy levels of three times us put together. I mean, she is absolutely like a whirlwind when it comes to the detail, understanding how to get these businesses totally singing. So I think shareholders can be absolutely confident that she's, you know, putting all of her experience for the multi-decades into these businesses to really make them to grow. The only issue outside is, you know, when you look at it as an outside investor, to me anyway, is that she's put a really high bar on herself because she's been so successful over the last 30 years. What she's trying to do is repeat what she's done before, i.e. she buys quality businesses at very, very attractive prices, turns them around, and then sells them again for very attractive prices. And when you do that over 5 years, you make your shareholders 10 times the money, 15 times, which is what she's done. But nowadays, that is not as easy as it has.
Yes,
it was ever easy, but it certainly isn't easy at the moment. And I think what's you applaud the discipline that she's, you know, put on the advanced ADF for her selection of companies, but it has taken a long time to seed effectively 50 odd million, you know, software cash, which she's bought at one time sales, which is like a terrific price over the, you know, over the time. But to repeat that is now much harder, and therefore it takes, you know, it's taken time to basically, you know, so why she's got so much cash, to actually seed it and to grow into opportunities. So I think what she's looking at both bolt-ons going forward, but I think she's also angling for something a bit bigger to be able to seed the other 100 million. However, you know, that's not an easy catch, because if you're looking for good quality software businesses, both in the public and the private sector, but particularly in the private sector, you pay more than one time sales, and you've got to have a really sort of, whereas, you know, because you just put the bar so high, it's great for, you're not, you know, for shareholders, you can be very comforted that it's never going to waste any money, because it's absolutely not that. But sometimes you need to actually seed that money to be able to speculate, to accumulate, don't you? But her standards are just so high compared to everybody else like myself.
I thought after the SaaSpocalypse sell-off earlier this year, I thought that she'd be awash with opportunities, but she was kind of saying, well, finding it a bit difficult to find suitable deals, which that did surprise me. I think there's still a lot of private equity and sort of sector money sloshing around that they're competing against for doing deals. But interesting on the public sector, she did flag up. Well, you look at who are doing well in the listed software companies. It's Kainos, it's TPX Impact, and it's Matchtech, who are all public sector focused. So that was interesting.
Maidtech.
Maidtech, sorry, yeah. Sorry. And then she also, I like the way, I mean, she is a force of nature as an individual, hugely talented and experienced and all the rest of it. But I like the way she mentioned her team as well. She said, I've got a really strong team of different personalities, different skill sets who kind of challenge me and rein me in and say, ah, but da, 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 da. So it sounds like they've got a really good team dynamic there as well, which I really like, because you don't want, you know, a kind of Mike Ashley type person just steamrolling everyone. So all in all, it was a fascinating call. And she was very generous with her time. So yeah, I've emerged a bit of a fanboy, I think.
Yeah, no, so have I. I mean, I would say, you know, I mean, I invest heavily into software. Okay,
yeah,
and I learned an absolute shed load from that conversation. It was just a real eye opener.
Yeah.
But if you're an investor who wants to get exposure to software, particularly, and I think this is a low risk exposure. She will not waste any money whatsoever. She'll run it like a really tight ship, and she'll make sure her investments, all of them, do really, really well. So if you want to use, you know, rather than actually buying a tech fund manager, she's offensively, in my view, the best of the best in terms of software investments. So if you wanted to just say seed some money into software, then she, I think, has got little downside and lots of potential upside, as long as you're patient.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's exactly the right way of looking at it. On my site, prior to this call, a little while back, actually, I upped it from ambergreen to green, ADVT. I think it was a trading update or something, where you could just look at the numbers and say, well, this thing's, I mean, it's not far off a no-brainer, really. You're getting the core businesses are excellent, and then half of it's a net cash pile that she's either going to spend wisely on something good or give back to investors. Yeah. I mean, it's got lovely optionality on it, I think. So yeah, I think the shares are great. I don't hold personally. That was it. It was the February results that came out on 29th of June, but it's certainly on my list. I've got 25 companies on a list that I want to buy, and this is one of them.
Okay, we've got a follow-up question, actually. We've got Simon Lee asking, he's desperate to know what Vin said about the M&C Saatchi, because they own a sort of 10% stake, and she owns personally 12%. I remember what, you know, what she said was that there's, you know, some of the parts, there's lots of really good businesses with their their issues business. They've also got a very successful sports and entertainment business, but together is worth more than the market cap.
That is it. Yeah.
And then the other business is valuable as well. So I think she's now getting her hat, because I think she's now going to be, she's deputy chairperson on the board.
And
I think she's going to look to turn around. Did you have any extras, you know, from that at all?
Yeah, I think Saatchi shares are very good as well, actually, as a standalone investment. I've got a valuation of over £2 a share on it. And as she just really confirmed what we thought already, that you've got two cracking businesses within Saatchi. And then I won't tell you the actual phrase she used for discretion terms. The third division, the advertising division, she said is very much diluting the the whole is less than the sum of the parts. So actually, have we got Harwood on the shareholder list here? It's the sort of thing they should get involved in.
Rockwood. Richard Staveley is a long-term shareholder.
Yeah. So I think Saatchi, I think people should do very, very well from here. Well, very well if they're patient, as you say.
Yeah, so, advertising. Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to consumer franchises. We had a conversation with Kate Box this week, CEO and founder Sukh Chamdal, and the CFO Michael Botha. Do you want to take us through? These guys do luxury egg-free sort of like cakes and stuff that go from their iconic shops, which are sort of like highly visible purple, I think they are. But I've tried the cakes a few times, particularly the platters for sort of 80th birthday parties and for my dad and for anniversaries. It's absolutely fabulous. But do you want to take us through how you see this business?
Yeah, I mean, I've liked Cake Box for a long time. It got into a bit of a mess a few years ago under the old FD. who made quite a mess of a few things. But the new FD has been in there about 3 years. He's, I think, was a South African chap, isn't he? I think he is, South African accent. Very down to earth, very straightforward. We like the founder here, I think. Again, he's just a hands-on entrepreneur, absolutely loves the business. There were no surprises from the call, really. It was just as I expected. You've got a generous dividend yield of about 5, nearly 6%. You've got a balance sheet that's fine. It's a franchise operation. What, interestingly, he said, you know, you've obviously had a bit of a downturn because of the heat wave and things like that. But he said they're protected from that because the franchisees have the day-to-day ups and downs. And he said, I think he said they don't have any loss-making shops because they're all franchises. So it is the franchise model does work very well here. And he just talked to us, you know, we did Q&A, didn't we, on the basics about how they run the business. I think it's attractive. I think it's a decent valuation. Yeah, I think it's very good, Kate Potts.
Yeah, and I think there's quite a lot of runway to go because they're putting in this new Shopify online ordering system that goes live in August that they're pretty excited about because I think their previous online system has been quite clunky, even though it's sort of still 25% of sales. But you can understand it because, you know, like myself, if you order it, you order it online, then pick it up at the shop, or you even get it delivered to you because they do quite a lot of that sort of stuff. So they've got a much slicker operation that should increase basically the sales and introduce the loyalty program. Plus they've got things like corporate events they've never really looked at, you know, leaving dues and stuff like that. They're thinking about putting vending machines in underrepresented areas and also doing some partnerships with the likes of Moonpig that you raised, or I think it's Moonpig rather than Funky Pigeon, but Spec Savers and the Entertainer. So I think they've still got quite a bit of runway. As I say, I got the impression, because of the hot weather, I remember covering the stock about 3 or 4 years ago, and there was a very hot period, and it definitely dampened like for like.
But it's bound to, isn't it?
Until... What was quite interesting also was that they've got a store footprint of about 300 shops at the moment in the UK, of which the sales currently about 50-50 Asian and then, you know, non-Asian sales. So that was obviously very, you know, sort of like concentrated originally in those areas. That's obviously diluting. And then longer term, they're looking to go, you know, abroad. They've got one of their franchisees who's set up a shop in Paris. They're going to see how that progresses, because I mean there's plenty of other, you know, sort of opportunities. If you've got a successful model, why not, you know, license it out, you know, basically say, okay, right, we'll give to a big potential, like obviously, you know, DP Poland or people like that, and then you put it to another area.
Yeah, no, it's all good. As I say, the only one question mark I've always had over Kate Potts that I've never managed to get a straight answer from is how much profit is booked on the signing of the original franchise deals for new stores, because they're opening 30 or 40 of them. And if that's a material number, which I suspect it might be, then when they do reach sort of UK saturation on store numbers, you could see a sharp decline in that profit line. And I did ask twice, but I didn't get a straight answer to it this time either. So think about what you will, but
I think that's competitive information, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah. Okay. We got Martin. He's asking about Alamask, who had a profit warning today. These are building products. They do roofing envelopes, vents and stuff. Plus, they've got these big stormwater drains which go into airports. Anyway, they've come out with a sort of 10% profit warning. But more importantly, actually, their CEO seems to have been suspended because of potential inverted commas misconduct. Whether that happens, any quick thoughts? It's the shares.
I don't think they did say misconduct. I think it said an investigation into her professional conduct.
It's
not quite the same, is it? I think that's the wording. I mean, of course, we all want to hear the gossip, don't we? What's going on? A bit of salacious boardroom gossip. Yeah. You can't beat it. But I think the key thing is she's only just joined. Paul Hooper, the previous CEO, is fantastic. He's such a nice guy as well. He stewarded this company brilliantly for many years. So he's only just retired. And this new Pamela Bingham, I think, has come in. And so they booted her out with a pretty you know, when you hear something like professional conduct and immediately, well, suspended, I think, to get the wording right on this. Obviously, that's not good, is it? But I don't think she'd really made her mark on the company at all because she'd only just joined. So personally, I'm not really bothered about that. I don't think it matters. And it's so that doesn't matter. And very, very poor communications from Ali Musk and the broker today saying it's broadly in line. No, it wasn't. It wasn't broadly in line. It was a 10% profit miss. It was a mild profit warning. You know, they don't do themselves any favours, companies who lie basically in the RNS and say it's broadly in line when it's not. It's just, you can't do that. So a big for that, but that's just communications, you know, you put that to one side. I think in current tough macro, missing your numbers by 10% is neither here nor there to me personally. You know, it's going to do 20p a share instead of 22p. Well, actually, in the current macro, I think that's okay. I really do. I've held this share for a year or 18 months or something like that. I'm not even remotely bothered by it. In fact, it's coming into top up range for me personally because I'm looking through tough macro. I'm looking to this with a 2-3 year time horizon, and I'm just looking through tough macro. Very nice, a decent 10% operating margin. It's got pricing power, but it's large lumpy contracts and terrific brands. You know, you ask anyone in the building trade, they know, but they've heard about Ali Musk. Oh yeah, you know, they're top. So it's a good quality business, currently good value, I would say. So yeah, I like it. But rose tinted spectacles, maybe, because I'm an existing holder.
No, I'm with you. I don't own the shares, but if I had some spare cash, that'd rather be onto my buy list, no doubt about it. And I don't think it's only got that lumpy contracts in those stormwater drains that they do at airports. The rest of the business is very much repeat revenue. Certainly the Timlock business, which does the air vents in roofs and stuff, is absolutely fabulous. So,
and it's true. I mean, talking to Lawrence Hulse, he of Onward Opportunities, he's a big fan of Ali Musk. It's very interesting talking to him about a site visit he did. He said they're so innovative. They're constantly tweaking and improving the products. They do next day delivery, I think, on the and they designed a skylight that could be just fitted by one person. It's things like this. They're really, it's a very innovative company, and that's where their pricing power comes from. So I think it's better quality than the market realizes. The only thing was, in the large, throughout the pandemic, it just seemed to defy gravity, didn't it? It just traded so well. And I think, you know, they had a 3-4 year period where they traded extraordinarily well. But finally, I think the tougher macro has caught up with them a bit. But you've got a beautiful operationally geared upside recovery thing in there, in for free, you know.
Yeah, I think this is just a one-time reset, as in, like, you know, if the CEO does leave after being suspended, then I'm sure they'll get there's a long line of people who would want to be very capable who would want to be you know, the CEO. So they just have to do a bit of recruitment if that ends up to be the case.
Yeah, I think you're right. So it's not a panic. It's not a panic sell for me. I read it before 8 a.m. and thought, this is going to drop 5 or 10% today.
Yeah.
And if it drops 20, 25%, I'll buy more. So it's that type of profit warning for me. So, yeah.
Agreed, Jeff. Okay, we've got a couple of people. We've got SpanCan460 and Jacob M6, both asking about Eagle Eye, which came up with a profit upgrade this morning. These guys do sort of like personalized loyalty and promotional software for large supermarkets around the world. Software company, lost a big contract about, I don't know, 18 months ago. Anyway, stripping out that contract, its ARR has just gone through the roof elsewhere. So it's up 31% over the past 12 months, increasing its EBITDA expectations and margins. Shares have recovered almost exactly to where, in fact, I think they are above the price they were when they originally fell. So how did you see this morning's very good news, actually?
Fantastic. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I mean, the Cavendish forecast for the current, for June 26 was increased 532%. I mean, when I read that, oh my giddy aunt, this is going to go through the roof today. But I think, as you can see from the relatively muted reaction in the share price today, I thought this would be up 20% plus today. But I think a lot of it was already in the price because the company has been making very bullish statements for a while now. But hats off to, well, to the company primarily, but hats off to bulls like you and yourself who said, look, the growth is coming through. It was a bit of a leap of faith a year ago. But it's paid off handsomely. Whereas I like to actually see, yes, the numbers have turned around. Yes, the growth is real. So for that reason, I doubled my position this morning at £5.2 from a half position to a full position size. Because, you know, for me, it's now much lower risk because it's not just guesswork or educated guesswork, admittedly. It's now, yeah, look, ARR up 31%.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. So they had a barnstorming H2, basically, didn't they?
Yeah.
And the big upside, some people at Mellow told me this, some very shrewd investors said to me, it's the deal with SAP that could really turbocharge growth. Mm. So, I mean, one of my correspondents reckons it's fully, it's up with events now. But I think... This was pretty, I think, a game changer today. Those figures are so good, aren't they? Anyway, you know it better than me, so over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, it's now just about my largest position. It's certainly up there with Active Ops and Alico and just a bit ahead of Tribal. So it's right up there, basically, sort of 10%.
Yeah.
There's no chance I'm selling any shares. I mean, this business is on a roll. It's just started its journey with SAP as its partner program. That could really deliver a lot of growth over the next 2, 3, 4 years. It's got that sort of seed contract in Mexico with Walmart that potentially, if that goes well, could get put into, you know, the whole of the States. And the reason why that's important, okay, is Walmart has always adopted everyday low prices, okay, not personalized promotions, right? It's always in the US, it's always been, and it's, you know, because it used to have Asda the same thing, whilst it owns Asda in the UK, everyday low prices. Now, if that trial, which they're doing in Mexico with personalized loyalty software, goes well, then there'll be no reason why they don't adopt the same technology in the US, because because I mean, you know, everybody else in the world does personalized loyalty and promotions, don't they? And the UK is probably the country most advanced in this. I don't know. I mean, I can see that. Who knows? It's always you can be optimistic with rose tinted glasses and all this sort of stuff, but I would not be surprised if this is over £8 in about, you know, instead of 18 months, a year and a half, simply because I think there's got power. And when I interviewed Richard Staveley from Rockwood, he thinks it's, you know, if this goes well, SAP is going to buy it, you know.
That's all compelling points here. I think, I was overly skeptical on the major loss of the contract, but that was because the profits were wiped out completely and it was back to break even. Whereas it's now proven that it can, it's fully recovered from that, basically. So to me now, it's lower risk, paradoxically, at £5 a share than it was at half that. Because the fundamentals have advanced, and you're always going to keep an open mind on these things, haven't they? When the fundamentals completely change and you get a barnstorming update like this, you change your view on it, don't you? So I think I'm up. I was slow to join the party, Paul, but dancing away now. I just like that. I like that degree of certainty. I don't like making these leap of faith type investments. I'd rather pay more once the numbers are being delivered.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's go to big technology. We've got Paddy MHBS asking about these guys do ankle bracelets for prisoners, for custodials. One of the world leaders in this in terms of sort of custodial and with prisoners, etc. They've had this problem with their major founder and shareholder, Sarah Murray, who's left, obviously, and they've got this overhang litigation. Any quick thoughts here at all?
The last time we covered it was the H1 trading update at the AGM, which was 23rd of June. Good margins, making progress. We just thought the valuation looks up with events, basically. It is an interesting company for sure. The legal issues seem likely to drag on, I think. I don't think there's any sign of that being dealt with. I mean, you've still got 21% of the market cap in net cash, and that's after paying off a substantial amount to the buddy shareholders. So and it was a confident in line update in June for calendar 26, so it looks interesting, doesn't it? But I think given putting everything together, it doesn't scream compelling value to me, which it did. I mean, you and I both took a trade on this, didn't we, at about 60, 70p. At that level, it was more compelling than it is now, I think. But and I don't know what the competitive environment is. So given that I don't really know the sector, I can't. It wouldn't be a compelling buy for me at the moment. But
yeah, and they have won a big contract in Chile, which is great because that replaces the one they lost with Colombia in South America. They seem to be making good inroads in the US. They trade at, you know, quite a reasonable 8.5x EBITDA. So I think once that potential litigation with the founder is settled, but I'm with you. I think that's going to take a long time. Certainly, Christopher Mills told me it was going to take a long time. But once that is, then I think this could be could be taken out by somebody. The problem is that depending on who the shareholder structure is, I mean, Sarah Murray, the founder, still has a blocking stake on a scheme of arrangement. She has about 27%, and I think her family trusts have another 15%. So she's potentially got 40%. So that may be a blocking stake. But yeah, I mean, it looks a good, very good quality company. And if they can increase the top line growth, then it will look very, very cheap indeed, because the margins are just to be killed for. I mean, the EBITDA margins of almost 50%.
Wowee. Yes. And I think when we've delved into this before, I think a lot of it is that it's not just the hardware, it's the software, isn't it? Because it doesn't generate false alarms and things like that, which apparently competitor products do. So yeah, interesting company for sure. Yeah.
Okay, let's move to stay in the tech. We got Claire. She's asking about one of yours, Beeks Financial. Did they come out with the results just recently? These guys do sort of software and hardware for high-speed traders through brokers, but also for the exchanges. They're going to a revenue share model with their exchanges. Done very well. But anyway, what do you want to take it up from here?
Yeah, it was fine. 15th of July, what's that, 2 days ago, we got the full year trading update. Record H2 in line with market expectations. And as always happens with this bloody share, it drops. Oh, so frustrating. You can tell Beak shareholders by all the lines and furrow brows we've got. It's a very frustrating share. The only negative, or it's a slight negative, that I think that I picked up from looking at the bulletin boards, some people didn't like that the cash balance had dropped. But I don't think they a little bit more than expected, but you're not looking big amounts. It was only about £3 million lower than expected. And people don't seem to understand the business model with Beaks, which is it's not cash generative because it's growing rapidly and it has to buy servers and cabling and install them up front. And it then gets the 10, 20 year growing annuity stream from it. You know, that is the business model. So when people sort of say, oh, you know, and they go through the numbers and they think they've uncovered some big sort of scandal in the number, nobody should be expecting this to be generating cash. That's not the way the business model works. And by switching to an OPEX model for the client instead of a CAPEX model, they're signing deals faster and getting them signed off faster by the client. And it also said that the revenue sharing model is performing well in a couple of recent installations. So I'm very happy with it, and I'm happy to just hold long-term on this. It's one of the best organic growth companies on the UK market, I think. But it is a bit tricky to value. I do accept that.
What's the organic growth rate on it?
PBT was up 13%. EBITDA was up 18%.
But the sales organic.
ARR was up 15%.
Oh, okay, right, fine.
So I mean, it's been higher than that in the past, but it is accelerating again now, interestingly enough. There was a graph in one of the broker notes showing actually a resumption of growth, because the other thing is you've got this AI market intelligence product, which they've just launched and has won 3 contracts from major banks. That's now looking like it could dramatically increase the total addressable market and the gross margins. And yet the market hasn't really attributed much value to that yet. So long term, I think we'll do very well on this, but short term, it's such a frustrating share.
Okay, good. Let's go to we've got Alan is asking about something we never talk about, Lend Invest, which is sort of like a specialist platform for buy-to-let purchasers. These guys not only put their own funds into lending out to people who want to do buy-to-let as a professional investor, but they also manage other people's third parties' funds to be able to do that and place it. Is there a bowl here, as Cotney Rebel would say? Because the shares seem to be increasing.
Yeah, one of my team, I don't know this share, but one of my team, John, he looked at it 2 days ago and he flagged it to me in our chat room and said, Paul, this looks really good. I think we should go up from amber to amber green. It is small. I mean, you can tell when you look at a chart like that and it's got those long horizontal bits, that's telling you it's very, very illiquid, isn't it? Very small. So, and it's only about 40 million market cap. But the announcement, the full year results to March 26 were very, very good. Profit was, it rebounded from a small loss to a big profit relative to the size of the company. Strong momentum, record Q1. It looks interesting, this, and you're getting it at quite a substantial discount to net tangible asset value. So we think this looks potentially interesting, quite low PE as well, but speciality lenders, you know, tend to not get particularly high ratings, do they? So it would need thorough research, but yeah, it could be something interesting there.
Yeah, the liquidity looks a bit, given it's got so many flat parts to it, it's difficult to drop anything of note into the actual shares, I think. But you're right, it certainly looks cheap, that's for sure.
Okay. Do you know what their USP is, Paul? What do they do that other lenders are not doing?
I think they just basically concentrate on professional house buyers, basically, or developers. I think that's what it is. The answer to that is, they probably, because it's buy to let, a lot of the banks have actually come away from that sort of perceived more risky area. I did actually, you'd think buy to let would be shrinking, because I know, given what's been happening with the renters' rights bill, you would have thought actually the market for buy to let would actually be decreasing. But I did see an article in the FT saying actually there's been more people have gone into buy to let recently, which is just like totally counterintuitive. So
yeah, TPFG on the call we had with them, they said to us, yes, a lot of mom and pop single property buy to lets landlords are selling up, but he said in nearly every case they're being bought by larger professional landlords. So that was quite it. And Foxton said something about the Renters' Right Act, didn't they, saying they'd have to reverse some turnover, which I think was related to students not being compelled to pay for the properties over the summer. I don't know if you heard about that.
Yeah, that, I mean, just for everybody, Foxtons is a London Southeast estate agents and lettings agency, and it came out with a profit warning, didn't it, this week? Yeah. And I think the shares went down, and as Paul rightly says, one of the drivers of that, I'll put the chart up, one of the drivers of that was a lot of redemptions or terminations of leases. And I believe what happened, because what they said in their announcement, it was related to students, because you've got a lot of people at, you know, digs and stuff like that, and therefore they've decided they're not going to stay in the property over the summer and therefore give the property back, and then we'll look to rent it out. Now, that should just be temporary, but it will lift prices for rentals, no doubt about it. And I guess the other thing would this be an impact for people like Unite as well? You know, basically student landlord. Now, if cast your mind back to when me and you were students, Paul, I think what happened, if you were in a student hall of residence, you were kicked out anyway. So you probably find that there isn't a bigger impact on Unite. But I think the whole thing in terms of Foxton's, is quite interesting, actually. And whether it's a good buying opportunity now at these levels?
I think so. Actually, if I had to either buy, sell or hold, I think with Foxtons at this level, I'd be a buyer, because it does have most of its lettings income. It should be pretty, pretty solid. I think the average tenant's about 4 years, isn't it, in private rental property? We had a quick look at it. I think it was yesterday or the day before. And we think probably, around about here, obviously a long and sustained downturn in the London sales market, but that is no surprise to anyone, is it? So reasonable value, I think, Foxton's actually.
Yeah. Okay, we got Rebecca. She's asking about one you own, which is, well, basically you've got Headlam and Likewise. Any quick thoughts on, they basically do flooring in the UK, and you've got one share price Headlam going south, and you've got one share price Likewise going north. It's sort of like totally diagrammatically opposite.
Yeah, it's playing out exactly how I thought it would, actually. As I bought Likewise at, I think, in the low 20p's, and it's been one of my best investments since then. And I think, you know, it doesn't look obviously cheap on the current numbers or even the forecast, but that's missing the big picture here. The big picture here is that Headlam is the dominant UK largest distributor. I think it's going to go bust. I mean, we've been saying that for a while. It's been living off sale and leasebacks, but the latest update from Headlam this week was really had some very, very worrying stuff in it. And you've only got to look at the market cap now. It's practically down to zero on Headlam. It's hemorrhaging cash. Who's going to want to do a sale and lease back on their remaining property when the covenant is so weak, you know? They've obviously got trade credit insurance problems because they said they can't get the right stock. You know, this has got all the hallmarks, I'm afraid, of a business that's going to go under. In my opinion, I don't know that for sure. You know, who knows? They could pull some miracle out of the hat. But like the obvious competitor, the obvious winner from that is Likewise. I'm amazed that Likewise shares haven't gone much, much higher. So I think we're on the same page on this one, aren't we, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, the market isn't the discriminate, as in, like, you know, it's the performance of the companies which is discriminating, and clearly Likewise has got the magic sort of, like, you know, sauce, the secret sauce, and is winning hand over fist against Headlam. And I'm with you. I think it's only a matter, at the moment, it's only a matter of time before Headlam does go bust, and it could be quite soon, actually. But
I think so. It's got, I mean, they are saying that they're in advanced discussions with the banks, Headlam's saying, but it does need sort of covenant waivers and whatnot. But there were far too many warning signs in that and previous RNSs for me to want to get involved at all with Headlam shares. I just wouldn't touch them. Why take the risk of 100% wipeout?
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, let's move back to software. We've got Lemon Physical asking about Alpha Financial, which does asset finance software largely for the big banks, but they do sort of like asset finance for sort of in cars, or they'll do off-road vehicles, or they'll do, you know, equipment, sort of big plant and equipment as well, say mainly for big lenders and the finances. They're growing in the States. They have a big software business, which is the ARR's growing, and they also have about two-thirds of the business is implementations, which is going to be a bit static this year. Shares have come off and obviously been hit by the SaaS apocalypse. But they have been increasing over the last, three or four months.
You better do this one, Paul, because I don't. Yeah. I mean, looking at the numbers, I can't see anything that particularly appeals to me. I'll pass it back to you because I don't really know anything about. Dominant major shareholder with 54%. That's the chairman, Andrew Page, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I own the shares. I mean, what I like about it is that it's very entrenched within the its customers and for the lenders. It's almost like customized per bank. So you're not going to strip it out. It isn't going to be vibe coded out, that's for sure. And I think with their ARR is growing sort of very strong double digits. And on that basis, then I can see them increasing their addressable market with those particular banks. And I think it's only a matter of time. They've had interest from private equity before in terms of buying it. And I think it's only a matter of time before it does get taken out. The problem you have is that the founder will not take a good bid. It'll have to be a knockout bid. It's spinning off a shed load of cash. You just got to be patient on it, in my view. I think it will continue to do well, but don't expect sort of like, you know, sort of anything to happen in the anytime soon. But it looks relatively cheap for a very, very high quality software stock.
Okay. I was going to ask you, with all these, after the SaaSpocalypse, have private equity approaches to software companies been repriced downwards as a result of that, do you know?
Well, what you've actually had is that a lot of the private equity have just taken a pause on public to private acquisitions. I haven't seen that many. In fact, even software companies, there hasn't been that much takeover. It's happened more in the sort of the engineering side, or industrial side. So I would say, yes, you're right. It has taken a pause. Is that because of valuation reset? I don't know. There's definitely still a big gap between public and private valuations. Mm. That's much cheaper in the public arena. I just think it's a matter of time, because what's happened is that you know, you've got a lot of uncertainty in terms of people's views of how AI will impact the software sector, the SaaS. And so you just got to come to one side or the other. I personally think B2B software can particularly entrenched applications will do very well simply because it's going to expand their addressable market and they'll be able to take more costs and spin up new applications much, much quicker. So the likes of, with, you know, Craneware, Eagle Eye, Pinewood, Alpha, Traxys, all these kind of guys should, in my view, do very well. But obviously...
Literally everybody we talk to on our joint calls is saying the same thing about AI, aren't they? They're all saying, distinguish between which are the software products that are totally embedded, mission critical, have to be 100% right. He said they're safe. They're not going to be affected by it. They're not going to be pulled out and replaced with anything to do with AI. But then look at the, I can't remember the terminology Vimaria used, but deterministic, I think, and something else. She said you've got a probabilistic. That's it. That's the stuff that is more vulnerable to AI. So I think you just distinguish. We're hearing this from everyone. So I think it's very clear now, which you and I both said originally when the SaaS apocalypse happened, didn't we? That, you know, you're not going to get mission critical vital software ripped out because of AI. And in fact, companies are developing AI tools, which are helping them to actually embed themselves deeper. So, yeah.
Yeah. Just on that software, we've got Vincent. He's asking about Cerillion, which is basically that telco software business that has got a huge contract with Omartel implementing it at the moment. Shares have been pretty weak of just late. Is this a buying opportunity?
It's on my list of 25 shares I actually want to buy. Cerillion, is on the list, absolutely. I mean, I think the valuation's come down from toppy to okay now. I mean, I know it looks cheap based on the chart, but it's still on 18 times forward earnings. You do have an issue with Cerillion that it doesn't have as high an element of recurring revenues as a lot of other software companies. So it is vulnerable to gaps in the order book, which is precisely what happened recently. But I think it's such a strong growth story that I think you just have to accept those bumps in the road. But based on the information we've got as of today, I think Cerillion looks interesting. I'd like to buy some, but you just never know when something untoward might come out, you know.
I remember when we both chatted to Lewis, isn't it, who's the CEO and founder there. And you asked him, what's your organic growth strategy? And he says, well, I'm going to double turnover in the next 5 years. And then you asked him again, well, that'll be another 5 years. He's going to double it then as well. So
I mean, he's just quietly confident. Yeah. And, you know, he's really delivered. I mean, the long-term track record of this company is amazing. The contract's getting bigger with bigger reference sites. It's got a lot going for it. But just don't expect, as you can see from the chart, don't expect a nice, smooth, steady line upwards. It's going to do this, isn't it?
Well, I think that's a really important point, because if you're going to go into software, then, you know, you've got to take the potential sort of intermittent drawdowns in prices, which can be 30, 40, 50%, certainly in down periods. But there aren't many management teams who are saying they can double revenue in 3 to 5 years organically. Cerillion's one.
Good point.
ActiveOps is another, and Eagle Eye is another. They're the only three I know who are doing, like, you know, 15 to 20% ARR growth consistently, and they see that through opportunity of their own business. So, yeah, I mean, you just got to, for quality like Cerillion, you just got to, I mean, it's a low price. You've just got to pay up, basically.
Yeah, I'd add Beaks to that list as well for organic growth. Very good points. Well made, Paul. I agree with all of that.
Okay, we've got a couple of people asking about one of your shares, Grant and Andrew. Brickability or Brick?
Oh, yes.
Did they come out with results this week or some sort of trading update?
Yeah, I'm really bullish on this. I have to say, I did buy some more just for full disclosure on the day of the results. It just seems to be permanently against a headwind of negative investor sentiment. But the figures were fine. They were great. I wrote up quite a detailed write-up on this for my website, shareideas.uk. And little plug there. And I went through the management slides, you know, the investor slides, and I learned quite a bit about the business. Turns out that most of the bricks they distribute are UK made. It's not, we thought it was imports, but imports is only a small element of it. And they've been rapidly building up their install and design division, I think they call it. They do things like remediation, fire remediation, for fire safety remediation contracts. And that has been growing really, really impressively, the revenue and EBITDA, offsetting the weakness in its core low-margin distribution business. So what you're actually getting is very, very good financial performance. And what they're saying is, as soon as the house building taps turn back on again, they're going to get just all this operationally geared flowing through straight to the bottom line on the subdued core business. And basically, you're only paying 6 times or 5.5 times PE for a business that is poised for an operationally geared recovery and has actually traded fine throughout the whole of the last 5-6 years. I think it's an incredible bargain. And you get 7% dividend yield, which looks sustainable. The cash flow bridge was very clear. This thing makes a good, strong, genuine cash flows. It's an asset light model, drop shipping, and it then uses the cash it generates, half to pay for acquisitions and half to pay your 7% yield. It's crystal clear. Very, very, very good opportunity in my view.
Yeah, no, it looks good. Okay, we've got a couple doing that same sector. We've got a house builder. We've got Jacob and there's another guy as well asking about Vistry, which is a problemed house builder. But they say basically they came out with a better trading update last week. And apparently one of their directors have bought £100,000 worth of shares. The shares have ticked up anyway from their lows. These guys do about two-thirds affordable housing and about the other third is private housing. But their balance sheet's a bit weak. And there's been plenty of scepticism in the press in terms of whether they're going to need to get covenant waivers from their banks. Anyway, how do you see it?
It's in my too complicated tray. I almost bought some the other day because I acknowledged the bull points that this could be a dramatic turnaround with the $39 billion of government social housing fund. That is over 10 years, though. That should be unlocked quite soon. And it reckons it can clear all its debt and move into a net cash position by the end of this calendar year. Well, if they do that, the shares surely would be going up, wouldn't they? So I completely get the bull case. But what makes me stop investing in this? Just because I don't feel I need to take that risk of something, you know, the wheels just suddenly coming off and the banks pulling the rug from it. And, you know, whenever you get into covenant waivers, you just, I mean, okay, they nearly always get granted, don't they? Especially if it's asset rich. But what are the land holdings actually worth in a fire sale? It could be way below the balance sheet value. So we haven't got enough information to judge this for sure. Whereas I can buy Barratt Redrow or Gleeson, where I just don't have to worry about any of that. And I've got all the upside without the risk. So I don't know. What do you think, Paul?
No, I've got the same strategy. I own Gleeson's. I anything where you get, you know, sort of like speculation in the press, particularly in sort of the FT or the Times and these kind of things. And I'd put Crest Nicholson in the same boat, Henry Boot in the same boat.
Yeah.
Then what happens is it scares the hell out of its suppliers, you know, your contractors and your, you know, your building product guys. And they start wondering whether they can actually give credit to those customers. And if for ever reason, you know, trade credit decided I'm not going to carry on or not to give it to the same level, then you do have that immediate liquidity crunch and it forces the issue. Now, the saving grace with Vistry, as you rightly point out, is that it's big. And it's looking at its balance sheet, it in theory should have a decent balance sheet, but it's clearly it's short of cash, and it could get saved by that £39 billion allocation of the social affordable housing. I personally take the same strategy as you, though. It's too risky for me, and I'd go for the easier play where I can hit a couple of doubles or a single rather than trying to hit the ball out the park, you know, because you can miss it totally and it hits your wicket.
Yes. Oh, very good.
Sorry about that.
Very relevant. No, exactly. I feel with Gleeson. I mean, I went back into Gleeson quite recently and caught most of this recent move. I take the view on that, like you do. If the cyclical housing recovery doesn't happen or is delayed or whatever, it doesn't matter. Just sit and wait. Whereas if you're in Crest Nicholson or Vistry and condition, you know, say bond yields double to 10% or something, and the housing market just collapses, you could be into 100% loss with those shares. Whereas something with no debt at all, they can just ride it out, can't they? So yeah, I can't see. And the valuation on Vistry to me isn't distressed enough for me to want to say, actually, I could make 5x on this if I get it right. Therefore, I'll risk 1x. To me, it's like, oh, I might make 0.5x or 0.7x, but I've got to risk 1x to get there, which just poor risk reward, I think. But good luck to holders. And there's a massive short position in Vistry, I believe, which could be double-edged, couldn't it? They could be right, because people who short usually are very smart. Or if they're forced to buy back, this thing could go like that, couldn't they? So it could go either way, really, couldn't it?
Yeah, no, last week I had a Dutch look. It's got 15% short interest. It might have changed now, but it's enormous. For UK terms, anyway. Okay, let's go sectors. We've got to go to fashion. We've got Ben Sharman asking about Dr. Martin's boots that's been through trials and troubles, but the share price seems to be sort of like picking up over the last month or so. I don't know if you've been selling more Doc Martins or sandals or anything.
Yeah, 15th of July was the latest update, AGM trading update. We thought this was reassuring. It's not a business that I particularly like, but I think it is a reasonably credible turnaround, and that's been reflected in the price we can see on the chart. But the big issue here is excessive inventories, and that hasn't gone away. It still has warehouses full of shoes that it can't sell, which means that you're deferring an impact on your margins, basically, aren't you, when you eventually have to bite the bullet and clear that stock. But obviously, shoes, they're not going to deteriorate, are they? So, guidance unchanged, it said, and on track with strategic objectives, which is nice and PR'd, isn't it, to be a little bit woolly and a little bit unspecific. So, look, good luck to people with it. And I think it is moving in the right direction, but it doesn't appeal to me.
No, I'm not a fashion expert, and I certainly wouldn't be going into that one in any way. No,
it's like Burberry again today. Burberry, yeah. $4 billion market cap for a really poorly performing business. Is the brand really worth $4 billion? I mean, Doc Martin, 743 market cap.
Yeah,
you know, it's a heft for a business that's really been damaged and underperformed by private equity.
Yeah. Okay, we've got one we don't talk about much. Stephen Griffiths is asking about Capital Limited, the drilling business. That I know one of your subscribers wrote a very interesting investment thesis on this particular business. But basically, it goes to places nobody else goes to. So it's places that they've got projects in Africa, Pakistan, all kinds of places, and it's usually gold and silver that they do this drilling equipment. So it's for mining and for construction. How do you see it anyway?
Not my area at all, but I thought that Simon, who wrote the article I encourage readers to submit articles that I curate on my website, and I thought it was a very interesting article. You've had, I think, Richard Staveley go through it in detail on your interviews. I think it looks very interesting. Forward P is only about 10. You've got a small yield. You've got a big discount to net tangible asset value. And it's also got this portfolio of investments, which apparently has been put together by very shrewd teams who know the landscape. You know, they're not just punting. They're buying stakes in things that apparently are very credible. We had a record quarter in Q2, which it announced yesterday, actually. That was the Q2 trading update. Revenue up 15%. I think it looks interesting, I have to say. But for me, it would only be a punt, because I'd just be sort of piggybacking on other people's research, because it's not my area. But yeah, tempted.
Yeah. Yeah, I think on some of the parts, it looks very, very cheap. The only query I think you've got to look at is that it's got this really big project with Barrick Gold out in, in Pakistan. It's the Rico Deek, I think it's called, project. That they've got, the whole region has got security problems. I think it's between Pakistan and either India or China anyway. Yeah. And so consequently, when it comes to the safety, if the government don't sort the safety of that region out, it becomes almost impossible to continue with that project. But it hasn't yet impacted capital at all yet. but it's by far and away its biggest project. If it did and put it on hold or even stopped that development, then it would be a major hit. You'd have to reallocate and reutilize that equipment, which would take time to redeploy. So I would say is that, you know, you probably need to, in your risk and your sort of like cost of capital, you probably need to build in, because these guys work in, you know, very sort of frontier markets, emerging markets. You should probably have to have a higher cost of capital than your traditional sort of 12%. I'd put it slightly higher. They're not drilling in nice easy areas of, like, you know, basically Cornwall or America or you know, basically Europe. It's in these really, really geopolitically difficult areas, because nobody else wants to go there.
Yeah, I see. No, very interesting. Yeah, it was sort of border skirmishes in those areas that you mentioned are frequent and often on quite a scale, aren't they? And very, very nasty as well. So, yeah.
Okay, good. We've got Joe. He's asking about one which has done really well this work. We don't talk about is Sys Group, which is like it's an IT value-added reseller in the UK. I think their exec chairman has been buying heavily as well. He bought about £100,000. The shares are up 40% this week. I think they're a bit like Made Tech and TPX Impact, that they basically help the government and other companies implement sort of digitization stuff. And also, I think they do cyber security as well for corporates. Anyway, what's your view on it? It seems to have really picked up here.
Yeah, it has. We had a good announcement on the 8th of July. Prior to that, we were just kind of not really sure, because it was loss-making. But it looks like it could be turning around now. We had results for March 26 year-end, which were another year of losses. But I think it was the Outlook comments that have got people interested. It said momentum has continued. And here we are. It quote, expects to exceed market expectations for financial year March 27. So it's basically an ahead of expectations update, isn't it? And you had Zeus upgraded the forecast by 100% to 1.8p. So we've asked rather cheekily here, is the jam tomorrow finally arriving? So there looks good reason for some optimism on this. So I would say, you got the wrong chart up, Paul. It's the ticket is... SYS.
Oh yes, you're right. Yes.
Yeah, you've got System One's.
That's the one. Yes, you're right.
Yeah. Look at that. Wow. The July update. That was 8th of July, so you can see that's really turbocharged it. So yeah, looking potentially interesting. Worth people having a dig into this, I would say.
Yeah, I think with the exec chairman piling in and buying big chunks of it, then that says just about everything. He's firmly believes in it. I think he's got about 13% now, but he's been buying. Yeah, certainly been.
I have a feeling this is the one where you're backing the man, you know, in that the guy who set it up, the chairman, EJ Chai, I think he's called. 13%. I have a feeling this was a vehicle he bought into to do a sort of to turn it around and transform it. I believe he's got a pretty good track record, but this is all from distant memory. Yeah. So I think that it's worth researching what he did in the past. So yeah, if he's buying nice big clips of stock, I've got it here. Yeah, 100,000. He's bought two clips of 100,000, hasn't he? That is, it does look interesting, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Okay, yeah. We've got a final. We've got a couple of people asking about MS International. It's Ricardo and Grant, I think. Basically, these guys, they're almost like a diversified engineering company. They've got a defense business that makes these sort of like, they're automatic platforms, I think, and naval ships to help gunners sort of like shoot down drones, which is for the US Navy. Then they've got this, is it a petrol station sort of like envelopes type business, where they build these shelters in petrol stations, and they've also got this forks business. Anyway, how do you see it?
I just see this as a defense business now. I think you can just ignore all the other bits. And that's pretty much what the company has said, actually. They've worked long and hard, many, many years developing these defense projects from scratch, it seems to be. And they've won these huge contracts. So I can see why people think it's really interesting. I have held this share before myself. I think it's very, very interesting. Owner managed, the guys have run it for 50-odd years or something. So you would imagine it'll be a retirement sale at some point, which could be lucrative. But unfortunately, the results yesterday didn't really impress. This was April 26 results. PBT was down 25%, but 15 million, still pretty respectable. They're basically saying, large lumpy contracts. That's the issue here. So I think it's a little bit like a Goodwin type situation where you have to make a bit of a leap of faith, say that there probably is something actually quite outstanding here, but that you're not going to get there in a straight line. It's going to be quite bumpy. So I do like it, but the outlook again we thought was rather mixed, a bit unclear. They were much more bullish, I think, back in April. Where which has miffed a few shareholders, I think. And there's no forecasts out there.
Yeah, well, I was just looking at that. I can't believe it.
It's one of these ones. I know. It's one of these ones where they just do what the hell they like. And it's annoying, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's 240 million market cap. Mm. To not have any forecasts out there, I mean, that's just saying, it was like two fingers up at shareholders. It's sort of like, okay, we're going to run this for our own sort of like, benefit almost, which is, just not on as much as anything.
It's not on. But when you are dealing with massive, individually massive contracts and whatever, I suppose they might say, well, look, we don't know. It's the defense ministries. Mm. When are they going to sign on the line? It could be this year, it could be next year. We don't know. So maybe that's the thing. But I don't want to sound negative because I think it's an interesting share. But we dropped it from green to ambergreen in July. This time when there was yesterday, just because we can't really value it because we haven't got any guidance.
All right, brilliant. Well, thanks again, Paul. We've been going now for another 80 minutes or nearer enough. So thanks everyone for your questions and look forward to touching base again. Same time, channel, same time next week. So thanks again, Paul.
Lovely. Thanks, everyone. Really enjoyed it as usual. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better, and that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.